studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Pamela Poland is my guest this week. Pamela Poland is a singer and songwriter who has spent most of her life in the music industry. In addition to her own records, Pamela Poland wrote great songs for The Byrds, Linda Ronstadt, and Helen Reddy, among others. Pamela Poland has a new album. It's called Hawaiianized. Joining us from her home in Hawaii is Pamela Poland. Welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
So before we talk about Hawaiianized, I want to ask about your life in music. You actually were like a little girl or a teenager when you got into the music industry.
Yes, I was completely a teenager. I had my first songs published by Sam Cooke's publishing company when I was 16 years old. And I met Ry Cooter shortly thereafter, and he and I became a performing duo for the next 2 years. I was 17, and he was 15 at the time that we got started with our duet.
How did Sam Cooke's publishing company come to hear your songs?
My mom was loosely associated with maybe it wasn't that loose. My mom was the personal secretary for a man who at the time was the music contractor for the Academy Awards. So she had connections into the music industry. Because I'd been writing songs since I was 9 years old, by the time I was a teenager, I had quite a catalog of material, and she was very supportive of me. And I think she wanted to get a sense of whether or not I had any viability in the industry, so she wanted my material to be heard by industry people to get an idea of whether or not this should be a career choice for me.
And the songs that you were writing when you were a kid and a teenager, do you still perform any of those? Are those songs that have lasted in your catalog, or are they long gone?
Oh, they're Linda Ronstadt recorded a song that I probably wrote when I was 15, but most of them are long gone, other than whatever demos I might have from that era. I definitely don't perform any of that music, but I do remember how to play the very first song I ever wrote, and I've been known to do so on command at parties.
So, Ryland Cooter, one of the greats in American music, how did you guys meet?
Well, we both grew up in the Los Angeles area, and in the 60s, well, actually, it still exists today. There's a guitar shop in Los Angeles called McCabe's. And in the 60s, McCabe's guitar shop was on Melrose Avenue in Hollywood. And down an alleyway behind McCabe's, there was a folk club called the Ashgrove. And I used to hang out at the Ashgrove a lot. I even worked there as a cashier for a time as a teenager. And Ry hung out at McCabe's. And so I used to go into McCabe's all the time, and I met Ry, and we both had a love for traditional music, especially the blues of the Delta area and Appalachian music and stuff like that. And we were kind of, as teenagers, what I might call budding musicologists, which Ry has definitely gone on to, you know, I mean, he's become an extraordinary musicologist, as anybody who knows of his music would know, since he's tried on so many different hats of music from all over the world. But in those days, he was just way into the blues, basically, and so was I. And he didn't sing, and I did, and he needed a singer, and I needed a guitar player, so we just glommed onto each other.
Well, how does a little white girl from Los Angeles in the days of Beatlemania and the Monkees get involved in black blues music?
I wish I could say I knew the answer to that. All I can say is I was drawn to it. I was drawn to it, just like Ry was drawn to it. And because Ry, well, actually, we both had a lot of access to people that were older than us that had extraordinary music collections. And we used to go and, you know, seek out these ethnomusicologists and sit in their basement and play their albums for hours on end. And then we'd find a song that we both just went wild about, and we were like, okay, let's learn that, and let's learn that, and let's learn that.
When I'm walking in the morning, walking in the evening too, I'm walking in the morning, walking in the evening too. Oh, Corina, I'm coming home to you. When I'm going up country, sorry, but I can't take you. Going up country, sorry, but I can't take you. There ain't nothing up country a gal like you can do.
And our goal was always to replicate the song as best as our poor little white teenage souls could possibly could. And if you would allow me, I will say that anyone listening to this show that's interested in hearing this music can go to wolfgangsvault.com and just look for Live at the Ash Grove, and they have two sets of me and Rye playing where you can hear that music.
Oh, how wonderful that! How wonderful that it's been preserved.
Yeah.
So, your first band, I guess it was a duo. Gentle Soul was a duo,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't exactly blues. It was more of kind of folky.
Well, because then I decided to pursue my own music.
Uh-huh.
So
that's
then
when you started
I went
writing
and,
again.
You know, yes. So all the music, the Gentle Soul only did original material. So we did my song and my songs. Rick Stanley, my partner in the Gentle Soul, also wrote, and we wrote songs together. So we did each other's individual songs, and then we did collaborations. And we were 100% an original band.
And how did you get a record out?
I was working. There was a club in Hollywood called the Troubadour, another famous, you know, performing club of the era. And I worked in a little bookstore right around the corner from the Troubadour. And I had my guitar in there, and in quiet times I would play my guitar. And a guy named Billy James came in one day to the bookstore, and when he saw that I had my guitar, he asked me, you know, what I did, and I probably just sang him a song or two right on the spot, and he pretty much flipped out, and I told him, you know, that I had a partner, and he wanted to hear the band, and so he did, and then he's the one that introduced us to Terry Melcher at Columbia Records. Terry's Doris Day's son, and was a producer at Columbia at the time. He was producing the Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders. And he flipped and signed us to the label.
You were involved with a dozen other loves last year. And I was out trying to conquer the world last year.
Gentle Soul, we were all about love. You know, we were the classic, you know, L.A., West Coast, 60s era, be here now, God is love, love best, you know, kind of band.
We meet again, and we get together.
It's alright for me.
We're talking with Pamela Poland, the legendary singer-songwriter. And your band Gentle Soul broke up at some point, and you became a solo artist. I know you had a couple of albums on Columbia.
Correct. Yeah, the Gentle Soul lasted about 3 years, and the Gentle Soul and my marriage to Greg Copeland, who I think you probably also know of, who's a superb singer-songwriter, kind of dissolved at a very similar time to one another, and I moved to Northern California. And about 6 months later, I came back to Los Angeles for a visit. I was actually looking to get back together with Greg, and he was no longer in a mood for that. So I was kind of there brokenhearted, and a girlfriend of mine said, "Hey, I know something we can do that will be really fun. Some friends of mine are going to go on tour, and they're starting rehearsals for the tour tonight on the A&M soundstage. Let's go listen to them." So she brought me to A&M, and we sat down and we listened to the first set of Joe Cocker and Leon Russell. Most of the members of the band were there by that time, and about, I'd say they had maybe six backup singers, of which Rita Coolidge and Claudia Lanier were there. And on the break, Leon came up to me and he said, "Aren't you Pamela Poland?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "I used to come and see you guys, the Gentle Soul, at the Troubadour all the time. I'm a fan of yours." And I was like, "Well, wow, thank you very much." And he said, "Why don't you get up and sing with us after the break?" And I go, "Okay." So in their second set of practice, I got up and sang with them. And at the end of that break, he came up to me and he said, these were his exact words, "You must come on the road with us. You must come on this tour." I toured with Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Joe Cocker and Leon Russell, for 2 months, and I was in the ensuing album.
You're in the movie?
And I'm in the movie, and so is my dog. That was a superbly crazy rock and roll experience. I was still signed to Columbia Records, and I wanted to go forward continuing as a singer-songwriter. And I actually had to kind of quit and re-sign with the label. And when I re-signed, because I didn't get the kind of support that I originally wanted from the label, I said, you know what, I'll re-sign if I get to meet Clive Davis, who was then the president of the label. And if I get a feeling from him that he's going to be behind me, if I get his, you know, personal enthusiasm, then I'll re-sign with the label. So a producer set it up for me to meet Clive in Beverly Hills, and I played for him live in a little private room. And he did flip. And for the next couple of years that I was with Columbia, I fully had his support behind me, and that ended when he was fired from the label.
Were you satisfied with the success of your first album?
Not so much, but Clive blamed all that on my producer at the time. I won't name any names. I'll just say that he was green at the time. I was the first person he'd ever produced. And I really liked him, and I loved working with him, and I was happy with my product. But Clive felt that there wasn't a viable single. And in those days...
You needed that.
And Clive has always been, that's been his thing. You've got to have a single. So he wanted, for my next album, he wanted me to have a really great producer. And he asked me to make him a list of my top 10 favorite producers that all were successful. And my number one was Paul Simon.
Hmm.
And my number two was Gus Dudgeon, who at the time was producing Elton John.
Elton John, right. Mm-hmm.
And Clive personally went about contacting all of them and seeing, you know, if they would be interested in producing me or at the very least interested in hearing me. Paul Simon was totally into it, but said that he wouldn't be able to do it for 2 years. And Clive didn't want to wait. So my second album was produced by Gus Dudgeon. Two-thirds of the tracks were recorded in London using many of Elton's band members. And the other third was recorded in Los Angeles using the great session players Leland Sklar and Russ Kunkel. And I'm still very proud of that album. But what happened was, once it was mixed and ready to go out the door, Clive got fired.
And it never got any further than that?
It never got any further.
And
because I was so closely associated with Clive, the record company basically threw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. You know, anybody that had a really close association with Clive was put on hold. In my case, my album was put on hold, and they just waited until my contract ran out, and then they didn't renew it, and they never released the album.
And were you able to get a hold of it, or they kept to the ownership of it and so forth?
I have a copy, but they own it, and they are now Sony, because Sony bought Columbia.
Yeah.
And Sony Japan wanted to reissue it some years ago, and they said that the people they contacted at Sony LA, New York, wherever they tried, couldn't find it. Couldn't find the masters. I've actually posted it on my website, PamelaPoland.com.
In fact, almost all of your music is posted up there. Right?
Yeah.
We're talking with Pamela Poland. You continue to record here and there over the years, and I want to talk a little bit about what you're currently doing, because now you're living in Hawaii, and you fell in love with Hawaiian music, as everyone who ever visits Hawaii does. And so now you're a performer of Hawaiian music.
This is very true. I've actually been living here on and off since the mid-70s, but living here in a very well-rooted way since 1995. And within the first year of living here, I joined what's called a hula halau, which is basically a school that teaches hula and all of the other Hawaiian cultural arts, chanting and different kinds of crafts, etc. And the teacher would bring her students out to perform. And whenever they performed, she had a little, like a little karaoke boombox kind of thing, and they danced to tapes. And I just thought that was a travesty, and I thought the Halau needs a live band. So I decided to take it upon myself to learn the music that the Halau was dancing to so that I could help form a band for the Halau to perform to. And my teacher, God bless her, threw me to the wolves very early on, long before I ever should have been performing in public. She had me out there singing and accompanying the dancers. And I've been doing so for, I don't know, 10, 12 years now. But now, for the last 4 years, I have an official ukulele quartet, and we are professional, and we've finally gotten good enough to really deserve to call ourselves that. It's been a process.
I want to ask you about how you kind of metamorphosized into that. I mean, the kind of singing that you did at the Ash Grove was kind of bluesy singing, and you did the kind of mellow thing for the Gentle Soul, and then your solo work is, somewhere between the two. I mean, you have a big voice, I guess you would say. But Hawaiian music is maybe a softer kind of thing. How did you adjust?
That's such a great question, Gary. I really have to give you some kudos for asking that, because that was not easy. There is a gentility to Hawaiian music when it's really done right, when it's really the authentic sound. Even the up-tempo stuff has such a rarefied gentility to it. It was not easy for me to tone myself down, so to speak. Yeah, I've still got that bluesy kind of red hot roots. They still live in me, and I still want a belt. And I get to, in the hapa-haole material, hapa-haole is Hawaiian flavored music but with English lyrics. And so in that material, where it's kind of, West meets Pacific, I do get to let more of myself, come out. But to be really authentic in the purely traditional Hawaiian music that I sing, I definitely have to get way inside to find my own delicateness and bring that to the material.
And I don't know a lot about singing, but does your voice come from a physically different place? I mean, is it more head singing than chest singing or something?
Wow, these are such great questions. The answer to that is yes, but not because it's Hawaiian music. It's because in my band, I am the default soprano. The other two singers in my band can't sing as high as I'm capable of. And so I default to the really high, I default to the falsetto position, basically. So I am singing in falsetto a lot. And I use what's called ha'i, which is that break. It's almost like a yodel kind of sound, that break in the voice that Hawaiian music is renowned for. So I use that a lot when I sing, specifically in Hawaiian language.
like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right. Sun, 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 here it comes.
Talking with Pamela Poland, tell us, where can we get Hawaiianized?
Hawaiianized is, right now it's only available in digital download, but it's available in at least three places. One is iTunes, one is Amazon.com, and I have my own music store, which is music.pamelapoland.com.
There's so much more to talk with you about, Pamela Poland, that I hope you will come back and chat with us some more at a later date.
Thank you very much. Can I squeeze one more thing in?
Please do.
Kamehameha Publishing Company, which is the most renowned publishing company here in the state of Hawaii, has recently signed me and my music teacher up to publish our ukulele songbook. And we don't have a release date yet, and it might not be until early 2012, but I'd like to come back when I have a book.
Well, that's perfect, because we often talk about books here on From the Bookshelf. And I look forward to your return visit. Pamela Poland, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. Aloha.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all that she does and how wonderfully she does it. Thanks, Breanne. And thanks ever so much to Pamela Poland for telling us her story and joining us this week on From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.